Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us this Tuesday morning. Coming up this hour on the show, the Attorney General is calling for state lawmakers to legalize recreational marijuana so it doesn't end up on our 2020 ballots as an initiative. And more than 1.7 billion pain pills were sold in Arizona. What's that? Where has that left the opioid crisis here?
But first, the museum fire near Flagstaff continues to grow, and a number of families have had to evacuate, while others wait for evacuation orders. It has been labeled the top wildfire priority in the U.S. right now. KJZZ's Laurel Morales attended this morning's media briefing and joins us for an update. Laurel, what is the latest information you've got on the museum fire?
So last night, a Type 1 Southwest Area Incident Management team took over and made the museum fire the nation's top priority. There are 600 people now working on the fire, and currently they're still saying it's at about 1,800 acres, and that is mainly because they weren't able to do an infrared flyover last night where they mapped the fire, because it was just too cloudy, too smoky. But we are still at zero containment.
And Laurel, what is the evacuation situation right now? For many people, and obviously you've lived there for many years, to hear that there are evacuations near Flagstaff sound especially alarming. I mean, really one of the more populated areas of the state.
Yes, we've had two neighborhoods evacuate, and there's about 5,000 homes in pre-evacuation mode. But the people that had to evacuate, many are staying with friends and family. There is a shelter set up at Sanawa Middle School. Friends who had to evacuate told me that all day long while they were packing and preparing their go bag, the dozen or so air tankers and giant helicopters that were flying overhead were rattling their doors and their windows. So it's a pretty intense experience.
This is a major priority in the U.S. A big crew is there. What are the biggest challenges going forward, and what's the plan to attack this fire?
The biggest challenges, we've been told, are the weather and the terrain. The fire is burning in the Dry Lakes Hill area, which is pretty rugged up in the San Francisco Peaks. Lots of beloved biking and hiking trails up there, but it's tough to get to. And so they are attacking it from above and getting boots on the ground, as they say. They are going to be using that trail system to try and box in the fire and keep it as small as possible today.
And Laurel, finally, here in the valley, we finally got some sprinkles, which is late for us in this monsoon season. Is there any hope that the weather will help fight this fire? Maybe some, obviously monsoon can bring lightning and wind, but it can also potentially bring rain or other precipitation.
Yeah, so yesterday it felt a lot like it was sort of a Charlie Brown day here in Flagstaff. Everybody was getting rain but us when we really needed it. I did feel a few sprinkles yesterday. The operations chief talked about the relative humidity levels really helping yesterday. We are still experiencing some erratic winds that are pushing the fire mostly in the northeast direction, which means away from the city for the most part.
From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, that is KJZZ's Laurel Morales with the latest on the museum fire. Laurel, thank you and stay safe.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
The question of legalizing recreational marijuana in Arizona has two unlikely allies. Attorney General Mark Brnovich is pushing for state lawmakers to create a program to legalize recreational use of the drug as a way to prevent an industry-crafted bill from making its way to the 2020 ballot. Governor Doug Ducey, who has been against legalization, says he is open to this proposal as an alternative to any initiatives. And here to tell us more about the AG and the governor's position on this is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. One of my favorite subjects in the whole world.
As we know. So tell us about this kind of surprising turn of events here. How did this come about?
I think there's a realization that it will be a recreational marijuana measure on the ballot and a realization that it could pass. Remember, the one in 2016 failed by only a few percentage points, and that was a badly flawed one where even some proponents of legalization didn't like it because of some of the provisions. What we've seen in the polling, what we've seen in other states suggests that people are warming to the idea. So what you've got is this question that in Arizona, if something is approved at the ballot, the legislature may not make changes. They can't repeal it. They can't make major changes. They can only make changes that, quote unquote, further the purpose. So I think the concern, particularly of Attorney General Mark Brnovich, is that we could end up stuck with something that has unintended consequences, that doesn't properly address the issues of teenage use, that doesn't properly address the issue of where people can smoke. The governor is a little more circumspect about it. He said, I want to see any proposal. But I think he also believes that given the nature of unintended consequences about anything approved at the ballot and the inability to change that, that in general, he favors legislative solutions versus initiative solutions.
Sure. What exactly is in a current initiative at this point? Do we know? And do we know who's behind these efforts?
Well, what we do know is it's being pushed by the dispensary owners. They're the ones who are funding it. They already have, I think, about $700,000 in the bank. We haven't seen the language. We know that it is going to be recreational. They're still debating some of the things. For example, where should people be able to smoke? Should we use the Smoke-Free Arizona Act and the tobacco as a guide there? Should people who have already been convicted have their convictions wiped out? I believe that they're probably going to start circulating the measure within 2-3 weeks. We'll actually get a chance at the language. They obviously aren't sharing it with me, but they're certainly sharing the broad strokes. And the broad strokes are, we have medical marijuana here. We have 200,000 Arizonans who have medical marijuana cards. The question is, why are we making people jump through hoops for a medical marijuana card when, in fact, for a lot of people, recreational use is to them no more damaging than alcohol or maybe just binging Game of Thrones.
Howie, as long as they're not sharing anything else with you, which I wouldn't really be surprised if they did, no offense. Finally, let's look at when it comes down to the legislature. You mentioned the governor is wary about certain aspects of this, but most GOP lawmakers, I think it's safe to say, are aggressively against any legalization of recreational use. How much does that even make it impossible, based on what the Attorney General Brnovich has said, that lawmakers will even take any steps?
Well, I think he's skeptical. I think that the position taken by Yavapai County Attorney Sheila Polk certainly reflects that. But the question becomes, if you take this goal line stance and say, no, 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 do you believe you can defeat it? Now, Chamber of Commerce is kind of adopting a wait and see. They're very skeptical that it won't affect employers and such. But the fact is that you look at the polling, and are you better off taking the victory you can get, something you can live with, versus something that suddenly you find out, well, wait a second, this doesn't address driving under the influence. This doesn't address packaging. This doesn't address the proverbial Joe Camel version of marijuana for gummies. And I think that may carry it. I think there are a few Republicans who recognize that, but you're right. To the extent that Republicans decide we're never going to legalize marijuana, great. But it isn't your decision any more than legalizing medical marijuana was your decision either.
Could be a tough political sell, though, for sure. All right. That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Arizona Corporation Commission saw a change in its lineup in January after Democrat Sandra Kennedy returned following a 4-year absence. Also, Commission Chair Bob Burns has been consistently aggressive over the past couple of years in trying to use the panel's constitutional power to look into the utilities it regulates, including Arizona Public Service. Those factors have led to at least a slightly different approach by the commission. In part, that included the implementation of a new energy shutoff policy following the news that more than one APS customer died after power had been turned off due to a lack of payment. With me to talk about her perspectives on overall efforts and policies is Commissioner Sandra Kennedy. Commissioner, let's begin with the new approach on energy shutoffs. What was your reaction as a commissioner and a resident of Arizona when you learned about at least one person dying because of a utilities policy?
We discovered, after asking APS some questions, that a death had occurred. Then we discovered, after making some changes to their disconnection policies, which those policies are in effect for the next 180 days, that they cannot shut off anyone. We have now discovered that there were two more deaths. The question really comes to mind, why didn't APS report this to the commission? It should have been an issue, and it should have been an issue firsthand for them to report to the commission, since we regulate them, that they had settled these two other cases.
APS announced that one of its vice presidents was being pushed aside and asked to retire, and another person is getting elevated, and the person who's getting elevated was very tied to the APS strategy of getting much more involved in campaigns in a way that the utility hadn't been for many years before that. Does that indicate anything as far as the attitude APS has toward regulation?
It says to me personally that APS still hasn't gotten the message, and putting that individual in control of communications, I think personally, is just a bad move on their part. Mm-hmm. And ignoring the sentiments, not just of the commission, but the sentiments of the public. I don't think that there's going to be a change unless Don Brand is gone. Mm-hmm. So until then, the commission has their hands full, and we just need to do our jobs and regulate them to the fullest extent.
And I know you want to hear from Don Brandt.
I do.
Is there a chance of that? What do you think it will take for that to happen?
Well, staff is currently putting together a letter, and we've asked voluntarily for him to show up. Now, before we could even put the letter together, they were already responding, saying that he would send his most experienced executives. Well, we're not asking for his most experienced executives. We want him to come and sit at the table and answer the questions. He hasn't even seen the questions yet. Mm-hmm. So we are, the legal department is preparing a set of questions for him to respond to. And it will also be an opportunity for us as commissioners to take some time to ask him some separate questions. And I hope that he will be amenable to that.
Your colleague Bob Burns was recently responding to Governor Ducey, saying that the commission is overreaching, and his answer was short, as Commissioner Burns' answers usually are, was, well, the governor needs to read the Constitution. What was your reaction to what the governor said?
Well, I agree with Commissioner Burns. I think the governor has a lot that he can do with the utilities that come under the purview of the legislature. And if it was so important to the governor, why didn't he have it on the table? And he could have implemented some rules, regulations for the entities that the legislature oversees. I do think that he is overreaching. He doesn't understand the Constitution. And I have basically joined Commissioner Burns and said, Governor, please read the Constitution. We're doing exactly what we're supposed to do.
APS, of course, had a rate hike situation. And as it turned out, a lot of ratepayers were paying more than they expected. A few were paying less. And the commission held a hearing related to that. And you're someone who wanted to see that rate hike reversed. The majority did not go along with you. But there is more to happen in this situation. Can you give me an idea of what you'd like to see as it relates to this rate hike case?
Well, I was quite disappointed. One of the things that, you know, even during the campaign, I talked about the rate hike. When APS first initiated their application, staff recommended that they give a refund because they were over-earning. Now, I don't know what happened to the over-earnings, but APS got a $90-plus million increase, which says that, well, maybe there was a little hanky-panky going on somewhere. Because of the way rules are set up at the commission, the best way to get to hearing or maybe trying to fix a problem is a new rate case. And we've asked APS to file their application by the end of October. I would have liked to have seen it a little bit earlier. Maybe 1 month is not, you know, so problematic. So October, and we will look into everything that they put in their application. And people keep saying, well, they're going to get an increase. Well, I think it gives us an opportunity to take a look at everything that they're doing, everything that they're making. I think they've got a lot of income. I think they get an awful lot in return from the ratepayers. And those are the line items that I think we should be looking at.
How partisan is the commission? Is it more partisan than it was? Let's say when you first start, your first 2 years, I know things have changed in your last 2 years and onward, as you said. Give me an idea of that.
You know what? I'm going to give kudos to Bob Burns. It has really been easy to work with him. My first 2 years at the commission working with Commissioner Mays was fabulous. My last 2 years working with Gary Pierce, it was so partisan. Being back at the commission and working with Bob Burns and the other four commissioners, it's been great. I don't always vote with Bob Burns. I mean, I find myself, I can vote either way. And it has really been great to have the opportunity to actually have amendments. We can have conversation. My amendments get on, not always, but just an opportunity to introduce them and have discussion about them.
Arizona Corporation Commissioner Sandra Kennedy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The Drug Enforcement Administration tracks every single pain pill sold in the United States. And now the Washington Post has sifted through those nearly 380 million transactions and published a searchable database that puts the opioid crisis into perspective. Here in Arizona, more than 1.7 billion pills were sold between 2006 and 2012. In Mojave County, that added up to 74 pills per person per year. So we talked with someone who could put these massive numbers into perspective a little bit. Nick Stavros is the CEO of Community Medical Services, which operates 16 opioid treatment centers throughout Arizona. And I asked him first, did these numbers surprise you at all?
No, not in the least bit. There's been a lot of reports and studies that have come out over the last few years that have looked at predominantly the marketing tactics of some of the pharmaceutical companies, and they've actually shown that where opioid pain relievers were more heavily marketed, you could find higher overdose death rates from opioids. And so the data that came out, I mean, it's good it's getting this publicity because I think it's putting more of a spotlight on the epidemic. Mm-hmm. But I think to most of us, it's not surprising at all.
So in your work, when you see people who come in for treatment, right, I wonder if you can give us a sense of just where we are now. You've done this for many years. Have you seen sort of all of the national and local efforts that have brought attention to, like you say, the opioid crisis have any impact? Are you seeing those numbers start to go down?
Yeah, not, I mean, obviously not as much as we'd hope, but you know, there's obviously a lot of progress being made in a lot of different states. And so in Arizona in particular, you know, even though they've shown that there's been a decrease in overdose death rates over the last year nationally, Arizona is one of 18 states where there's actually been an increase in overdose death rates. And so much, much more needs to be done.
What kind of challenges are you still seeing in terms of why they're ending up there?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is actually highlighted by this report. And it is that approximately 1 in 20 Americans are on high doses of long-term opioids for chronic pain. That's a big number. The research says that about 34% of people on high doses of opioids for chronic pain say they are addicted to their medication. And so we know that there's a lot of people who have what's called opioid use disorder. That's the diagnosis. But that number is severely underestimated, because when you look at the amount of people throughout the country who are on opioids for chronic pain, they're not being diagnosed as having an opioid use disorder, so they're not getting into treatment. Hmm. So the question we in the treatment community ask ourselves a lot is, what can we be doing to get people into treatment, to help navigate them into treatment? It's a great example in Arizona, where we've done a lot to cut back on prescribing. In fact, prescriptions have gone down pretty dramatically over the last few years, yet overdose death rates from opioids has gone up, which means that when we clamp down and create a more restrictive environment, it stops people from getting prescriptions for opioids, but then they turn to heroin or fentanyl on the street, which is much cheaper, yet much more dangerous. So you see this increase in overdose death rates. And so that's something that I think we all need to do a better job of, is not just clamping down on the prescribing, but actually navigating people into treatment, because we're more and more so seeing people getting kicked out of pain management clinics, getting cut off by their primary care physician, and coming into treatment after they had turned to heroin on the street or something like that. How nice would it be if we could actually navigate them into treatment prior to them turning to an illicit opioid?
How would that work? Would that be something that physicians would need to be looking for?
It's really, really hard, because it takes the entire system working together. So let me give you an example. We worked with a pain management clinic in Tucson where the doctor was identifying patients who he thought had an unhealthy relationship with their medication. And he'd say, hey, I want you to go talk to a clinician and a physician at Community Medical Services. And they'd come over to us and we'd have the conversation with them, like, hey, you know, your doctor's said that he thinks you might have an unhealthy relationship with your medication. Let's talk about treating you. And I think 7 out of 10 times their reaction is, wait, you're calling me a drug addict? Right? Because there's this stigma against being addicted to the medication or being dependent on it. And so then when we say, we want to help you, we want to treat you, they say, don't call me a drug addict. You know, I don't need your treatment. I don't want your treatment. And then all they have to do is go find a prescriber that's willing to prescribe, right? So it's really easy for everything to break down if you have a couple prescribers who are outside of the standard of care, or if you have payers that are not paying attention to the utilization of their patients. It just takes a couple stakeholders in that scenario to make the whole entire thing fall apart.
I want to ask you a little bit about how the chain of sale works, I guess, right? So the Washington Post is looking at pills sold in various states to various pharmacies. So here it was Walgreens and Humana essentially got the vast majority of the pills that were then prescribed to patients. What role does a pharmacy have in this?
Yeah, well, the chain, so the chain you're talking about, it goes from the manufacturer of the medication to the distributor of the medication to the retailer of the medication, which is the pharmacy, to the prescriber, which is the physician, to the patient ultimately. So if you look at that entire continuum, there's a lot of areas in there where things could break down, but there's also a ton of regulatory oversight of that whole chain to try to prevent things from breaking down.
Right.
I do think that pharmacies and the pharmaceutical companies, everybody in that chain actually has some responsibility for ensuring that opioids are not being illicitly diverted. I mean, in Arizona, there's the case in Mojave where there was four prescribers in particular prescribing something like enough opioids for every resident in the county to take, you know, 4 times a day for a week. I mean, just exorbitant amounts, right? I think most people would say that's suspicious. Why did nobody in the chain report that?
Right.
So maybe sometimes they do, but I think one of the concerns is that that's not happening frequently enough.
All right, that's Nick Stavros, the CEO of Community Medical Services. Nick, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The newspaper industry is on the cusp of undergoing another dramatic change, and this one would directly affect Arizona residents and journalists. Gannett, the owner of the Arizona Republic and USA Today, among others, is reportedly deep in talks with Gatehouse to merge into one company. It's a step that would likely help more publications stay alive, but how many layoffs would follow, and what kind of impact would it have on the kinds of stories and number of stories that get published? John Leach is former managing editor of The Republic and currently an adjunct journalism instructor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is with me to talk about the Gannett Gatehouse chatter. John, you're in the newspaper business for many years. When did you first see the shift toward dramatic change, including consolidation?
It hit home for me in about 1999. There was a sort of some research done at The Republic about Central Newspapers, which was then the owner of it. The Pulliam family had created that company. And there was a decision that it, as a middle-sized newspaper chain, was just not viable. You needed to get a lot larger. And the decision was to put it up in, up for sale, and eventually that Gannett bought it and took it over in 2000. And just the need for this sort of scale of the industry was going that way. At that point, the internet had been around for a few years, and there were lots of questions about what does this mean in the long run as well, and that became a much bigger issue later as well.
John, how big a concern was it at the time that journalism would be deeply affected, not just in terms of perhaps jobs being cut, but the way that journalism was approached by larger companies?
A lot of concern. I mean, at that point, we were sort of experimenting on the web and trying to figure out what it was going to be like and how it was different. And if you look at the early experiments with newspapers and some of them originally owned TV stations, for example, and trying to figure that out. And they thought you'd have, you know, on TV, you would basically read the newspaper, and that's not the sort of TV we consume today. And likewise with the internet, it's like, what does this look like? How much multimedia is there? Is video possible? Later, of course, we found out it was possible. People stream on their phones today, but a whole lot of things in terms of storytelling we hadn't anticipated. What was underestimated, I think, at the time, too, was the advertising effect, which is that's been the steepest and decline the newspapers have faced and caused them some real financial concerns, and that's what's driving a lot of change in the industry, is it just steadily declined in print revenues, and they haven't been able to get online revenues up to replace them.
This merger is, I presume, not to really preserve journalism. It's more to see if advertisers might like a more consolidated company, right?
I think it's both. I mean, both do produce journalism, Gannett of a higher quality than Gatehouse. And I would sort of contrast them as Gannett is frugal. It's not a profligate sort of publisher, but it does earn Pulitzer Prizes, sort of the highest level of journalism in that way. Whereas Gatehouse is really more penny pinching and very careful with the money. If you look at layoffs, Gannett's had one this year. Gatehouse has had two, and both have particularly had heavy layoffs in their smaller publications. They seem to be kind of protecting the larger ones like The Republic in Arizona.
Well, John, how could this affect things on a national basis?
I think there's a short-term positive, which is that it saves money. These two companies, if you put them together, are 265 daily newspapers. That's one in six in the country, and its circulation would be 8.7 million versus the next largest would be 1.7 million nationwide, but all really done in largely in small publications, not large ones. The Republic is bigger than anything that Gatehouse now owns, for example, in terms of the newsroom staff. So it has that kind of effect. It's being done partly to get bigger, and there are savings that way. You don't have to have two human resources departments, two finance departments, two corporate headquarters, et cetera. But also it's being done to sort of buy some time as they still are trying to figure out what the business model it is that would produce the kind of profits that they have shown in the past, and they're just not there. Big savings like this, it's a bold move, can help prolong them in that sense. There have also been warnings that come the next recession, badly in the last recession, the next recession, there could be as many as a fourth of the newspapers in the country could close. So, you want that kind of, you've got some time to figure that out. Can they figure that out fast enough?
As an adjunct professor these days, what do you tell students about working in journalism? I mean, do you steer them away from newspapers? Did you love it so much that you say, well, there are still opportunities out there? How do you look at it?
I think there are opportunities, and it's a challenge they have to figure out. It was a very stable industry when I came out of school, and I kind of knew where I was going. Newspapers were making good money, et cetera. But what the advantage they have is incredible storytelling skills that didn't exist back when I came out. But the challenge they have is that it's an evolving industry. Newspapers are cutting jobs. Internet startups are not gaining jobs as fast as newspapers are cutting them, but there's still opportunities there. And there are things, you know, KJZD does more today than it's ever done before. TV stations have gotten larger. So there are jobs out there that I just tell them that, you know, there are challenges for you. But if you can get one, wow, the storytelling opportunities are incredible.
At its core, how much of this merger would be about survival? This is better than going away completely and going away completely faster.
It's a matter of staying alive. I mean, if you look at the steady decline in advertising revenues across the newspaper industry, calling it that, I guess, it's alarming. They can't sustain. When I was at the Republic, we merged to print and online newsrooms in 2007. We have 425 employees, positions that we filled. And today there are about 140 there. So that steep decline has pretty much reflected the decline as well in advertising. So you are looking at, you know, profit margins have dropped, et cetera. So you're looking at how do we survive. So to me, this merger becomes a way to survive. I would favor it in that sense versus being more vulnerable to an end. And not that the Republic is vulnerable. It's a profitable newspaper within the Gannett chain. There are others that are not so much so, and they might be more vulnerable.
John Leach is former managing editor of the Arizona Republic, currently an adjunct journalism instructor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. John, thank you for the time today.
Thank you.
This is The Show here on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger along with Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, columnist Amy Silverman on the challenges faced by families caring for children with developmental disabilities. And as you might have noticed if you went outside today, the forecast is predicting some monsoon action this week, and it's just in time for our summer series, my favorite time of year, the monsoon series. So we need your help for this. This year we are telling stories about how the monsoon storms awaken our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and yes, taste. We have a good one for that. So if you want to join in, if you want to tell us your stories, there are lots of ways to participate. Just go to monsoon.kjzz.org and find out how to tell us your story.
I really want to know how you taste the monsoon. Thank you, Laura.
It's coming.
Governor Doug Ducey's decision to pull up to $1 million in incentives for Nike continues to raise questions because it wasn't his decision alone to make. Arizona Commerce Authority CEO Sandra Watson is responsible for awarding grants from the Arizona Competes Fund, and she, unlike other agency leaders, doesn't take orders from the governor. Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Mirror wrote about this and joins us for a few minutes. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning.
So you reported Ducey has no apparent legal authority on this. So what authority does he, in fact, have in this case?
Well, certainly he has a bully pulpit. He has influence. I mean, he's the chair of the 19-person Commerce Authority Board of Directors, or 19 voting members. There's a lot of non-voting members. He's the chair or the co-chair. So obviously, he has kind of a position of prominence there. But the Commerce Authority CEO, Sandra Watson, she's not an agency head in the same sense of all the other folks who get appointed by the governor or like the old Department of Commerce, which the Commerce Authority replaced back in 2011. You know, it's this board of directors that hires the CEO. She takes her direction from them, not necessarily from the governor. So when the governor says, I'm ordering the Commerce Authority to withdraw this $1 million offer of an incentive to Nike over the shoe imbroglio, he doesn't, you know, that's not a binding order. Sandra Watson does not have to follow. Now, she did, but it's not something she necessarily has to do.
Well, the governor was compared in some cases to President Trump in that way, and that he was sort of barking out things via Twitter to say, this is going to be done. Almost, it doesn't even seem like he needed to have the authority. As you said, the bully pulpit was there for him.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it does not look like there was a lot of debate over there. I mean, Sandra Watson very quickly, you know, the Commerce Authority very quickly decided it was going to kind of follow suit. Said, you know, we have, the way they put it to me is that we have, you know, we followed, this, did this under his direction. We agreed with his decision, so we moved forward with it. Now, they still haven't answered questions for me for why they would follow an order like that, you know, when the governor does not necessarily have the authority to make it. I mean, obviously, this is an organization, and the CEO is a person whose their entire job is to foster economic development in Arizona. And withdrawing an offer of $1 million grant from the Arizona Competes Fund, it's not necessarily going to be good for this project. Now, Nike is coming to Goodyear anyway, but, you know, it could have gone the other way.
Is there any sense, Jeremy, of the repercussions that the Commerce Authority has faced for this? Are people mad at them, or as some of this has all this sort of fizzled or gone toward the governor?
I think everything can kind of go into the governor, whether you loved his decision or hated it. Everyone's kind of training their fire on him. Now, I think one kind of side note, side issue we may see coming out of this is the Arizona Competes Fund, the deal closing fund is often known. This has not always been especially popular, especially with conservatives who don't like to see things like government incentives, government interfering in free market decisions. The fund's been kind of whittled down a little bit over the years anyway, and the fact that Nike decided that losing this $1 million grant wasn't going to deter it from opening this manufacturing facility in Goodyear, I think this that could definitely put kind of a target on the Arizona Competes Fund next session.
Yeah, for many people it does come up with, whether it's GPEC or something else, if this place is so appealing, as Governor Ducey likes to say, and sells how great Arizona is doing economically, why do we need these kind of incentives at all? Do you see, just based on your crystal ball and knowing these things, is this something that the governor, based on what Lauren said, the governor sort of felt a little backlash on this and maybe more tentative stepping in, or is this maybe a new Governor Ducey, perhaps?
I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, this seemed, I think for those of us who have covered the governor for a long time, this seemed very out of character and very, like you said, kind of Trumpian in the way that this 2 a.m. Tweet storm. You know, Governor Ducey is generally a much more cautious person, much more tentative. The kind of thing that we saw in Nike, like, is a very out of character. So I don't know if we'll see that more often. If we do, this is definitely going to be kind of a new Doug Ducey.
Is there any possible reassessment? Would the legislature have to do anything with the Commerce Authority? I mean, would there be any changes we could potentially see there because of this?
I mean, like I said, I think some folks might have their eye on the Arizona Competes Fund now, which this it's at least started out as a $25 million fund. I believe it's a bit less now. And the Commerce Authority is still very active with it. So I don't know that that's something that, you know, the governor's never been an especially big fan of these kinds of government incentives. But the economic development community, I think if the legislature were to target that, I think there'd be definitely kind of some uproar there.
Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Mirror. Jeremy, I don't see you wearing Nikes, but thanks for being here anyway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it may only be July, but school is about to start in some districts around the state. Wickenburg School District, just northwest of the valley, starts on the 29th as they roll out a new four-day school week this year. It was one way Superintendent Howard Carlson told us they worked to attract new teachers to the rural town this year as a statewide teacher shortage persists and education funding remains a challenge. I spoke with him more about it earlier this morning.
You know, I would say that funding is definitely an issue, and it is one of our top concerns. When we look at the 20 by 2020, it does not cover all of the cost. And so it's an ongoing issue. But even bigger than that is Prop 206. When you look at the fact that we will be paying classified staff $12 an hour when we hit January, that has been a real challenge because of the fact that we don't have the ability to raise prices. You know, we're not McDonald's where you can pass it on to the customer. So those costs come out of our budget in other locations.
And Prop 206 being the minimum wage increase that voters passed, how much is that affecting your budget at this point?
It's affecting us in a fairly major way. The bottom line is that although it is it's a great idea and we appreciate being able to pay staff at a higher level, the problem is that we have no funding to be able to offset that, nor do we have the ability to raise funding for that offset. So that's a real challenge. And then the other area in terms of funding, I would say, is special education. You know, that gap continues to grow in terms of the issues we have with funding, and the formula has not changed over a long period of time. And so, you know, we will have situations where we have students based on their need that cost us twice what we might receive from the state and federal government to actually take care of that student.
So you mentioned at the beginning there that the funding that came through the state government in the last year or two here, the promised 20 by 2020 salary increases for teachers and some of the other funding have not done enough. Have they helped at all?
Oh, they've been a blessing. And they definitely have been a boost to morale and a boost to the school districts in terms of the dollars that we have to increase salaries. So we're very, very happy with that. The thing that I was pointing out is that although we have flexibility with those dollars, we don't necessarily have enough to cover the actual need. So as an example, a counselor or a social worker or a classified employee would not be covered.
Teacher recruitment and retention has been a big issue as well, and obviously is related to funding, but we are still looking at a pretty significant teacher shortage in our state. Is this something you're facing in Wickenburg?
You know, right now, at this point, we aren't, but it is an ongoing concern for us, and it is a concern statewide. In Wickenburg, you know, we've tried to be very creative in terms of what we've done. We've added van pools from the valley. We hire international teachers. We pay existing employees finder's fees if indeed they bring in a colleague. We also are switching to a four-day week. And with the switch to the four-day week, we found that we had a 32% increase in applications. And we have everybody hired by the middle of May.
What was that the goal going into this switch to a four-day school week? That's, you know, not happening everywhere. Were you hoping with this you could attract more teachers? Was that the idea?
That was absolutely the idea.
Huh.
And we knew that we needed to be creative. And this was one method that we looked at that when you look across the country, you saw that, you know, morale would increase and, you know, you had the ability to actually bring in people that you might not otherwise. And based on our location, it really helps to have an incentive like that to attract people.
All right. That's Howard Carlson, the superintendent of the Wickenburg School District, joining us just as school is about to start there. Howard, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And now our monthly conversation with longtime Phoenix writer Amy Silverman. Her new column in Phoenix Magazine is called Raising Phoenix. In it, she writes about culture, politics, and everything else that make Phoenix the city it is. Today, we'll be talking about her column called Home Care Woes, which details the experience of two parents caring for their 16-year-old son who has intellectual disabilities. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Silverman more about this and started the conversation by asking how she got connected with this particular aspect of the issue.
Well, to be honest, for me, it's personal, as a lot of my work regarding disability is. My daughter, Sophie, who is 16, has Down syndrome, and one of the first things I learned when she was born was that if she'd been born a couple generations ago, we wouldn't have really been given an option. She would have gone to live at an institution. And there are still institutions, I've done some work on them, in Arizona. Well, there's one in particular where there are much older people with Down syndrome who have lived there their whole lives, living there. But you know, kind of the first thing that I learned when she was born was that, well, a couple generations ago, Sophie would have gone to live in an institution. And the second thing I learned was, but she's not going to now. People keep family members with intellectual disabilities at home, and even family members who have intellectual disabilities who are medically fragile. And that's a much different situation. And that's a lot of the population at Hacienda Healthcare, from my understanding. Are people who are medically fragile as well and really need round-the-clock care. And that's the case with the boy who I wrote about in this column. So in that regard, he is different than Sophie, but he, like Sophie, gets state services. And the idea is that it's so much better to keep everyone who you can keep in the community in the community.
Why are families making this choice? I mean, obviously, yes, it's better to have a family member at home if you can, but it sounds like there's a ton of challenges with that.
Right. And I don't think it's feasible for everyone, because even if you do get services, it's still difficult financially to do it. And you need to have a flexible work schedule, particularly the way that the services are handed out in Arizona. You're not necessarily guaranteed that there's going to be somebody to care for your loved one all the time. But people want to keep their family members close. And then after something like what happened at Hacienda, they definitely don't want them in a facility like that.
So you mentioned state services. Does Arizona make it as easy as it can for families to do this, to get the kind of care they need, or are there challenges with that too?
Arizona tries. There are definitely people at the Department of Economic Security whose hearts are in the right place. And I believe that lawmakers have not always, but often tried to make things as good as they can. And actually, Arizona does not have a bad reputation nationally, but it's still very difficult for a lot of people, mainly because there's a lack of financial resources. There's a lack of people who are willing and able to do the job of caregiving. So even if you have access to the money to pay them or the agency that will pay them, it can still be almost impossible to find someone.
Do the families tend to have somebody round the clock or near round the clock, or are some of them able to do some of the caregiving themselves?
I think a lot of families do a lot of the caregiving themselves. I think it's pretty unusual to have round the clock caregiving unless you're paying for it out of pocket. I don't know what the maximum is in terms of what you're able to have, but I did focus on a particular family whose son needs constant attention, and they do have people come into the house through the state. And he also goes to school where he has a lot of care provided by the school and the Department of Education. But, you know, if he's up in the middle of the night, so are they. It's a process. And he's had a lot of health problems, which made things even worse. And that's really what upset his mother so much. And it's the topic of the column that at a time when they needed even more services because Micah had physical issues related to Valley fever and other things, the state decided to cut back on his hours.
One of the things that really struck me in your article was that one of Micah's parents had experience in the healthcare system and still found it sounds like, exceedingly frustrating to work through the bureaucracy and talk to the right people and really get what they need.
Yes, his mom has found it very frustrating. And on top of that, Micah is a kid who almost automatically qualifies for services. One of the things that I found in my reporting is that most of the people with intellectual disabilities in the state don't qualify for any services at all, or at least they're not receiving them. Because just because you have an intellectual disability doesn't mean that you're going to qualify for anything.
So what does the answer seem to be here? I mean, does the Valley need more facilities like Hacienda? Does the state just need to allocate more money and other resources for families who choose to keep their loved ones at home? I mean, is there another option here?
That's such a tough and important question. I believe, and this is not necessarily a super popular opinion, but I believe that what families need more than anything else is options. And if a family feels like they cannot adequately care for a family member who's medically fragile and requires round-the-clock care, I believe there should be a safe and affordable option for them to receive care, whether it's in a group home, and group homes are problematic, or an institution. And the I word is about as bad as the F word these days, if not worse, particularly in this community. But I do believe that there need to be options. You don't ever want somebody to feel like a situation is an optimum for everyone in the family. And then, yes, there need to be better resources for family members who do choose to care for their loved ones at home.
The family you profiled, I get the sense that regardless of all the challenges, that there's really no way that they would do anything other than what they're doing.
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. They would do whatever they could to keep Micah at home.
All right, that's Amy Silverman. She's a columnist for Phoenix Magazine. The column is called Raising Phoenix. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.